relevance is key. Try to find a way to include some of your accomplishments that are relevant to the company that you're applying for, the value of the company that you're applying for, or the job title that you're applying for. If you're applying for a UX role, then whatever project that you work on, whatever competition, make sure that it's relevant to that role, and then you will stand out.
Hello, everyone. In this episode, I'm talking to Amy, who is a UX manager at Canonical, which is the developer and publisher of the most popular Linux platform, Ubuntu. And we talk about her career story and how she transitioned from engineering to design. We also talk about work culture differences between Thailand and Germany and how work culture in Germany helped Amy learn to say no. She also shares experience working in an early stage startup and the differences and the sacrifices and all the other nuances of working in such a small team. We talk about transitioning from senior UX designer to a UX manager and how the job of a manager differs from an individual contributor. She also shares her thoughts on the remote work culture and what it takes for a company to be successful at remote processes, remote work processes. And then she also shares some resume and interviewing advice on how you can stand out from the rest. And a bunch of other interesting insights. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Welcome, Amy. Welcome. How are you?
Good, good. It's a wonderful Friday.
Thanks for coming to my show. Thanks for
inviting me.
Being willing to come and share your story, very inspiring story, with more than one transition, I would say. And I'm sure lots of learnings and lots of takeaways from your career journey that I'm looking forward to ask some questions and share with the audience.
So hope really it's helpful.
Yeah. Let's start with, as usual, with your career journey, your story. Why? Because you started as an engineer, right? So kind of I look through some of the story on your LinkedIn profile, and then you transitioned to UX, and then now you're also transitioned not too long ago to a management position. So you have like several different transitions, and I'm curious to hear, how did it happen? Why did you even get into UX? And what do you do today?
Right. So I have a background in computer engineering, which was inspired by wanting to understand my father, who's an engineering professor. I wanted to understand his mindset and why he's so deeply into engineering. So I studied computer engineering as a major, but back then, as a student, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just know that it's cool, you know. And during my fourth year as an engineering student, I got a scholarship to attend this program called Stanford Thai Exchange Program, where you have to propose a project and use Stanford resources to work on your project. And I was lucky enough to be mentored by a graduate student who was in the HCI lab. And that was the first time I was exposed to UX design. And that was also the first time I realized that this is what I wanted to be. And when I went back to Thailand, where I was from, the position called UX design is so new. People don't know too much about it. So I stick to the more conventional job, which is software engineer. My first job is actually at IBM. I was there for a little while. And then I tried to create a startup with a group of friends. It failed. And I was a software engineer for about 3 years, doing Ruby on Rails, Angular 4, also Node.js and JavaScript. And then I think right around 5 years ago was when I had an opportunity to go to Berlin, where they offered me a UX design job. Mm. So I went to Berlin to start fresh, transition from a software engineer to a UX designer. And that was the first time I get to do what I actually wanted to do in my life. And it turns out Berlin wasn't for me. The lifestyle in Berlin was a little bit different. My husband and I felt like we want to go somewhere that's more fitting of our lifestyle. So we moved to the UK, and that's when I found Canonical. And I started out as a senior UX designer at Canonical 3 years ago. And right now I'm a UX manager.
Nice. Now, I have a bunch of questions to dig deeper.
So that's long story short.
okay, let's start with the first question. How would you describe, from just your personal experience, the culture differences, like work culture differences between Asian part of the world, Thailand, and right. Europe? Because I'm now in the phase because I just moved from Canada, from North America, mm-hmm. to Europe myself less than a year ago. So I'm constantly kind of almost like not like indirectly comparing just the mindset and the culture and just how people treat work, life, kind of this combination of parts of a human's existence, most of human's existence. And I'm just kind of really curious, how does Asian part of the world compare to Europe, if you have any observations like this?
Oh, I have a lot of comparison to share. So when I was working in Thailand, there are a few things that we think that it's normal, but when I moved to Berlin and the UK, it's not really normal. And one of them is time management. A few times when I was in Thailand, sometimes your boss might text you out of working hours, and in some companies that's considered very normal. But in Berlin, I was educated about my rights to my own time, and like I have the right to work within my working hours. So that was kind of like a culture shock for me at first. There also this element of like being soft-spoken, and you know, in meetings, sometimes people don't really speak up or say that, oh, they disagree with your ideas or try to pitch in new ideas. They just listen in and
in
maybe
Thailand.
In Thailand.
Yeah.
Okay. And by the end of the meeting, they might come to you and say, hey, I sort of disagreed with you. And you know, that's the purpose of a meeting. You're supposed to tell us that you're not agreeing with the meeting. So sometimes that's a cultural difference that you might have to observe a lot and try to ask the right questions. There's no right or wrong to this, but I guess part of it came from the fact that our education is different. It was something that stemmed from being in school, and you have to be soft-spoken and, you know, being really more of a collectivist mindset versus individualist mindset in a way.
Exactly. And this is exactly what I was just thinking, because I think like the overall culture differences, like in different parts of the world and different nations, influence even like the work setting, right? So like in more Eastern world part of the world, there is more like this social influence and like thinking what other people would think about you if you say this or that. So kind of like there's a bit more broader set of considerations when you try to speak up, right, or speak out. When in the West, and I think it's kind of similar between North America and Europe from that point of view, that as you're like completely right, I have the same, I guess, understanding that it's more individualistic, so more like kind of really a person's opinion is almost like sacred, and like nobody can stop you from sharing it, like regardless of what others think, and people are kind of accept this. But I also think that in your particular situation, because I've never worked in Germany, but from what I've heard, Germany is like one of the more direct cultures.
Yes.
So it's almost like you kind of went from one side of the spectrum.
Yes.
To like the opposite side of the spectrum with like directness, and people don't keep their thoughts to themselves.
Yes. One of the things that Germany taught me was to say no, and it's fine to say no. One of my weaknesses when I was still working in Thailand was I have a hard time saying no, because I felt like, is that going to make me look bad? Is that going to make me feel like I'm an unhelpful person to my colleague?
Like a slacker.
Yeah, like a slacker. But then in Germany, everyone just said no, and I was like, I felt fine when someone says no. And then I realized that it's okay to say no, and there's nothing wrong with it. And so I become better at it now. I'm still learning, but I'm not perfect yet. But I think I've become a little bit better.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. And yeah, I also had, because I also kind of come from, I guess, some Asian influence on the culture from that part of the world. And when I moved to Canada, I also kind of, it was an interesting contrast about like really perception of saying no, and kind of almost bending your boundaries to comply, all right? Like
right.
With asks at work, which kind of was norm at my hometown, but wasn't kind of, wasn't normal in Canada, in Vancouver. But yeah, it's very similar. So how does Germany compare to UK? Is it similar or different?
A bit of both. So one of the things that I struggled a lot living in Germany was that I know zero German. And it was hard to read contracts or understand certain rule of laws and, all the paperwork and stuff like that. When I moved to the UK, it's a lot easier because it's in English, and it's easier to not have to translate three times just to understand what's going on. There's also this service mindset where in Berlin, people are, I wouldn't call them rude. It's just that the way they are and their language sort of shape them. So sometimes when I go into restaurants and you ask, what do you recommend here? Most answers is, well, it's your life. You should choose what you want to order. Whereas in a typical place that I go to, I'm more used to, getting answers like, oh, if you like sweet or salty, go for this. If you like something more on the spicier side, try this menu. It's more about like service minded, I guess. That is a little bit different, but otherwise it's more of a question of what you're used to in life. It's not like that's good or bad.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So it's definitely a personal preference, and there is no kind of right or wrong. It's just kind of whatever you like. It's the same kind of with the reason why I decided, or I wanted to, actually, I felt I wanted to move to Europe from North America, just because the culture of everything in Europe
fits your lifestyle.
After visiting it three times, kind of really felt, I couldn't shake off this feeling that a culture of food, of music, how people spend time, even like how cities are built, cheese, tea, coffee, like there is just so many components of like daily lives that I realized were much closer to what I'm kind of my heart was leaning towards comparing to North America. And it just kind of, it means that for me, at least for now, living in Europe makes more sense. It doesn't mean that North America is bad, right? Like there is like, actually there are really better things in North America,
yeah.
For some folks, and even for me, like not everything is rosy in Europe, from my point of view, but it's definitely a personal preference.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I have to admit that I appreciate public transportation more living in Europe. I grew up, you know, being in a car all the time and get stuck in traffic. And after moving to Europe, I realized that, oh, public transportation is actually awesome.
That's true. That's actually another difference here. In North America, public transportation is, I guess, not the top priority because it's probably more vast territories. But yeah, I'm enjoying public transport here as well in Europe. Speaking of that public transportation and the problems of public transportation in Bangkok, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you worked on your own startup. Is it that startup that you were referring to when you were trying to solve traffic problems?
Yes, so it's actually a startup that my friend started, and I really like their mission, so I joined them. And one of the biggest problems that we want to solve was traffic congestion in Thailand.
And you that said was, it failed, right?
It failed, but it was also the first time that I get to utilize what I learn in terms of UX. Creating design wireframes, also a little bit of coding, a little bit of everything, learning startup technical terms, and getting to know more of the business side of things. So that was a huge learning curve.
Yeah, I keep hearing from folks who experienced working in like in a very early stage startup that it's very intense. Every yeah. day is like some fire,
but you're burning learn a lot. Your savings.
Yeah, and you're learning a lot. It's kind of one of the main benefits. So if you can afford it, I think it's definitely one of the good ways to almost like speed up your growth and your learnings. And what's also kind of I had experience with startups as well. What also I think a very crucial benefit of working in a startup is that because you're not too remote, you're not too distant from the business side of the question, so you're like almost like in one pot, right, boiling together, that you also indirectly and directly learn about all the other aspects of what makes a successful product and company and business, which I think a very essential piece of becoming a more experienced and more mature designer, like UX designer, when you're not just thinking about the user side of this, but also it's almost like you're finding the right balance between the business needs, because you understand that like if it's not a nonprofit, there are goals you have to meet, right? So it's not you're going to truly overclock on the user problems. Definitely. And user needs, and you have to kind of be more smart about this.
Definitely.
Would you work in a startup again?
It's a good question. I haven't really asked myself that, but if I were to work in a startup again, at least I know what are the stuff to look out for. There are not a lot of things to look out for.
You mean the process of vetting a company to join? Oh, yeah.
I guess I have a little bit of hunch for things that I should be careful with and things that I should avoid in terms of like joining a startup again.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot because especially like in North America, there are like more, it feels like there are more startups like popping up every day. And I'm talking like both like Canada and mostly the States, obviously. And, I've been considering like a real, because I remember that the pace of learning was so much faster than like in a big tech or like the more corporations enterprise kind of level. So there are like pros and cons to different kinds of companies, right? And I kind of miss some of the maybe lack of formalities,
right?
In startup, like especially when you work like in a big corporation that's afraid of being sued for like anything they can mm-hmm. say or they can do. So it's kind of, there are like so many boundaries,
yes,
which I understand why they're there. Mm-hmm. And probably I would do the same thing if I were in their shoes. But I kind of miss that, like, agility of sorts and, like, really guerrilla style activities and actions from a startup.
But actually, agree, that's like, the fun part too. Like, you have an idea and you want to do a hackathon. Let's do it tomorrow and let's get it done.
Yeah,
it's really flexible.
It feels like they're moving faster, and I mean, unsurprisingly, because there's like fewer things to move, fewer people to get this approval or kind of alignment with, like with big companies is like more, I guess, the pains of growth. I would put it this way, I think like it's definitely maybe not for everyone, this experience, and not for every stage of life and career, I would say.
Exactly.
So I've been thinking, like, and the reason why I tend to kind of stick with like bigger companies in the last few years is probably just kind of also responsibilities of like unpredictability of like the success of a startup, especially with like your example is also kind of proving the point that the vast majority of startups fail, right? Mm-hmm. And even though you learn a lot, but like, can you afford to get this learning? Because you also kind of almost like pay with your sanity sometimes, and your anxiety and stress levels, and sometimes even money, right? So it's definitely, yeah. There is a cost to these learnings.
I guess as you grow, you learn to take fewer risks along the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And at one point in life, probably you can afford to take those risks.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Now I have a bunch of obligations and responsibilities that is just going to find a bit more less risk. On the risk tolerance scale, I'm kind of lower risk right now.
Right.
But yeah, I have really good memories of the old times of the
boldness and just do anything.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about your current job. And you mentioned that you joined the company Canonical as a senior UX designer.
Yes.
But then you transitioned to the management track. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear for you to share the story. First of all, why did you decide to go the management route? Because it's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. What maybe signals that you or clues that you got from thinking about your maybe feelings or thoughts that made you think that it's actually the right path for you? Or maybe you're just kind of just experimented and trusted your gut feeling. And maybe you can share like some advice for folks who are in this situation when maybe they reach this senior level designer on the IC, like the individual contributor path, and they're not sure if it's worth pursuing the management track or switching to the track. Because not every company has enough support to answer this question and to help them figure out if that's the right thing for them. And what happens, I've seen too many times that really smart, talented, almost like genius level individual contributors as designers almost like indirectly pushed because there is expectation in the, especially in the tech world, that you kind of keep growing. Mm-hmm. But somehow there's like this stereotype from the old times that the almost like the next step for a senior designer is to go to the management route, which I've seen people not making happy from this move. I'm curious to hear your story and maybe any tips, any red flags or things to consider.
Right. So when I started as a senior UX designer, I was working on a product called MaaS, which is a data center provisioner. And as much as it sounds like a technical product, I have to admit that I utilized a lot of resources I studied from my operating systems class. So it was one of the hardest products I've ever had to work with because of how, you know, things that you study is usually dated 20 years back, but things that you're currently working on, you can't really Google it because it might be in textbooks in the next 10 years. And that was the challenge during my senior IC kind of time. So, just because I have some background, it doesn't mean that I didn't do anything. I sort of set aside 2 hours after work every day to study about cloud computing, virtualization, and, you know, just reviewing the stuff that I know from my operating systems class and then build on top of those knowledge. And also networking is one of my weakness because I'm more into like data science specialization, and having to work with networking topics, I have to familiarize myself once again with
those. And by networking, you mean computer networking? Computer
networking. No.
Relationships building.
No. Computer networking.
Just make sure.
Yeah. And so those were the challenges during my senior UX designer days. And my manager was kind enough to test me out with different challenges. So I was given a few, you know, tasks to test how far I can go and how much I can contribute. For instance, I would get a task to work on the CLI design. And somehow that CLI work that I did become sort of like a guideline for Canonical's CLI standards that other products have to follow.
What's CLI?
Command line interfaces.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, like the prompt command stuff. Or there are different integrations between different applications within Canonical. Stuff like LexD or Linux container. How do you integrate that into a private cloud kind of environment, or set it up through mass integration? And that was another hard topic that I have to work on. Or stuff like SmartNICs, which is the smarter version of networking card, where it works like a computer inside a computer. So there are these different concepts that I have to work with throughout those individual contribution days. And after these, I guess, the output of what I produce was more visible to people in the company, to other senior leadership, they kind of see my potential. And as the team also scale up, my manager asked me if I can help him manage junior people while he handles the senior people. And that was how I transitioned from senior to lead and then to UX manager. And I'm still new to the managerial role. I have to be honest with you that I'm still learning on the job, and there are a lot of things that I still haven't really get a hold of. But it's a different set of problems that you're solving as a manager versus as an individual contributor. When you're an individual contributor, you get stuck into a feature and you can work on it for 2-3 weeks just on one thing and just to clarify whatever you're working on. Whereas when you're a manager, you're solving people's problems, 5 different people problems. And every single one of them have different concerns, have different feedback receiving styles, have different ways of taking your feedback or understanding the goals of their products. And some of them need your help, but they don't know it. And to be in a situation where you're busy all the time, but at the same time, you also have to understand their needs, I think that's the biggest challenge as a manager.
Yeah, I've heard that the management job is almost a completely different job. And, and from how you describe it, especially, I kind of didn't think as much about, because I've heard about the types of the problems are different, right? When you work as a manager versus a designer. But I didn't really think too much about additional complexity that you just mentioned, that all, like each team member will likely have different communication style and different preference for receiving feedback and also, communication style. How would they express the problem, the exact problem, right? So kind of like almost, yeah, kind of like a therapy. Therapist skills are needed to be a manager for
big time.
Yeah. So you're more, I guess, smarter about how you phrase the same information, the same answer to different people, knowing how they, what's the best way to communicate, so they get the message right, right? So because it's could be very different,
exactly.
Especially when you work like in a global company, and as I understand, Canonical is like fully distributed company, right? Because there's like such a probably unique mix of different cultures, and each culture will have their own expectation of how they communicate, how they listen, and talk to others. So it's probably additional complexity with a variety of that.
And I guess when you interview people to understand them, so you can solve a problem for the product, you interview different people, but you're trying to look for, you know, those patterns that these people have in common. Whereas as a manager, it's the opposite. You talk to them and you're fixing their individual problems. And it's not going to be a common pattern. It's going to be very individual. It's going to be very specific. And it's going to be very different in terms of products as well, because you're working on different products.
So this begs a question. Which again, like just your personal experience from your story, and I'm sure that the answer will be different for other folks. But how likely would you recommend a UX manager job to a friend on a 10-point scale?
A 10-point scale. So one being stay away, and
yes, and like the typical NPS score.
I think you will be exposed to a different level of complexity. It's not going to be the same. I can't really put weight into how I feel or if I would say, yeah, let's go for it, because, you know, different people would have different preferences. But what I can say for sure is during my transition from being an individual contributor to a manager, there will be a point where you're struggling to understand the purpose and the scope of your work. There will be a point where you're like, am I still supposed to try to make this product better? Or is my scope to grow people? Which one should I focus on? How do I manage my time? Where do I put my time into? Do I put my time into understand other people's products just so I can grow them? Or do I put my time into making my product really well? And that transition is the hardest part. Once you go through that transition, it becomes easier. You will have a better time management for yourself. You will know where to put time on to make it more efficient. And if you feel like if you're the kind of person who likes to be stuck with one topic and really drive it to the finish line, stick to individual contributor. But if you're someone who thinks that, hey, it's time for me to grow other people, to build a team who can do what I do, then maybe management route is the route that you should take on as a challenge.
That's actually a very good segue into my next question. So what, and you already kind of, I guess, gave this advice, like as a one point particularly about the focusing on one product or feature and then like kind of getting to the end, more focused, I guess, approach or mindset. But how else a senior designer or even like an intermediate designer potentially can, like, what should they be looking for in their own thoughts about what they do today to understand or kind of get these clues if management potentially a better track for them to kind of work towards?
Wow, that's a wonderful question. It's really hard to pinpoint a specific skill, to be honest with you. But I believe that if your peers sees your potential, that's one of the best signs that maybe you're a good manager and that may be the right thing for you to do. People skill is very important. And also, I guess one of the more important things to think about is how do you understand human psychology? Because you're going to be dealing with a lot of human psychology than ever as a manager. And if you like, you know, listening to people and understand their problems and try to work with them to bring results, then this is a sign of you being ready for a management and a leadership role.
That's a very actually good point, and kind of help me remember one of the interesting thoughts about, I guess, overall manager as a leader, as a team leader question. And what I realized some time ago that, like, obviously after talking to many, many people in different roles, in different levels, like management or IC, is that my conclusion is that the definition of a manager that the person strives to be, if they're a manager, is also different.
Yes.
And so there's also kind of no right or wrong. So, and this goes back to, I think there's like 7 different management styles. And if you kind of add the communication style and like all other parts, all other influences of the person, like from their career growth or even like life story. So maybe actually I would love to hear how do you define an amazing leader?
Wow. An amazing leader. Actually, I have one role model at Canonical who I think he's an amazing leader. And I always look up to him whenever I have a problem or I needed advice. And he's always the one who like puts my mind straight how to solve a problem or how to help my reports. I think a good leader or a good manager is ready to listen to you and is not going to pick sides, but will be influencing you in a way that allows you to see different scenarios instead of one side of the story, and also encourage you to do your job really well. And that person will also have to understand the goal and the vision of the company, what the company needs, what the team needs, and also what your report need as an individual to grow in your career and balance that out. And also be ready to have a hard conversation when the time comes, because that's the most challenging part so far.
Yeah, I've heard about this many times, and this is actually kind of one of my, I guess, almost like probably single main con of going this route, and like almost like some kind of, I feel that there is a resistance in me just thinking about this part, which is an essential part of being a manager, right? So yeah, it's definitely would you say you can train this with more repetition, almost like kind of practicing a skill And I'm talking about especially the more challenging times and turbulent times in the economy and the market, when manager has to deliver bad news to some of their team members. Have you had to do that? And
so far, not yet. But there has been scenarios where I have to determine whether someone needs a performance improvement framework or not, or you know, how to grow that person and make sure that person is up to par with the standards, along with the other UX designer in this position. There has been scenarios where I have to think about how I can improve and help this person towards, you know, making the team strong again.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, definitely, yeah. One of the things to keep in mind that it's not all rosy being a manager. Sometimes you have to deliver bad news.
The biggest part is also you want to talk and take out the emotional side as much as possible, because when you reveal your emotions in front of your report, sometimes a conversation can turn into a different conversation that does not result in a good output. And so the part where you have to play poker face is one of the things that I'm still learning.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about your current workplace, Canonical, right? So maybe let's start with the open ended. Like, why did you choose this company? Why did you decide to join? What exactly you found appealing in what they do, how they do it, that you decided to choose this company over others?
First of all, it's an open source company. I've always wanted to work at an open source company. And back then, I didn't know that Canonical is a company behind Ubuntu until I moved to London. The thing is, what I love about Ubuntu is, out of all the Linux distributions, Ubuntu is the first one that just give it out for free for people, and not enterprises, but like people, so they can have access to computers. And that really aligns with my values, where I think, you know, computers should be for free for everyone, and everyone should be able to contribute back to the stuff that they love. And after learning about Canonical, I realized that this is the same value that I have with the company. And so I join Canonical mostly. We have a headquarter, which is in the UK, but we recruit people from around the world. So you don't have to be in the UK in particular. We have an office, you know, for legal reasons, but from an employee perspective, everything is remote. 70% remote, I would say.
70% of the employees
are remote. Yes, they can be in anywhere in the world that has internet connection, and you should be able to work.
Sounds like a more, I guess, mature approach to handling work from home practices.
And I guess it's one of the coolest thing ever, because you're not obligated to have to travel to the office every day, and you can manage your time. If you have a child, you know, you can stay home with your child and still work.
Yeah, this is one of the topics I wanted to talk to you about. So recently, there has been a bigger push across many tech companies to send everyone, like all their employees, to the office, back to the office. It's like the RTO, return to office acronym. And it feels like it's almost like a trend now, like, and very mysteriously pushed everywhere at the same time, kind of feels like it. So it's kind of interesting to kind of I'm curious to learn why this is happening so commonly. But I know there are quite a few examples of very successful companies who built all the systems and everything to work remotely, even before COVID, right? And they arguably are quite successful, right? And I wonder why it
works.
Maybe you can share maybe your insider's observations. How some companies can make it work, and why others do think push everyone back to the office, because it's almost like a hot topic right now online.
Right. To be honest with you, there are companies that I work with that has had work from home policy that didn't work, and this is one of the companies that worked. And the difference is, one, you can track the person versus you can't. In some companies, when you give too much autonomy to the employee and it's hard to track, it becomes harder to, you know, track the work or plan the work. But at Canonical, we have a very solid plan for what we want to do in the next release cycle, which is 6 months. And it's very easy to track the work from individual, because we have sort of like an agreement that, oh, if you wake up, you say good morning, and that's, we know that you're online, and you say good night every time you check off. And we can always ping people while they're available and know that they're going to be there. So trackability is one of the biggest, I guess, aspect to working from home. For some companies, people who has never worked from home before, they need to earn it, because otherwise you just lose track of them and you don't know where it is. And when you need them, they're not there. And that's the most frustrating thing ever. But the fact that you're trackable and people know that you're available and you're there is one of the biggest factor to build trust in a remote kind of environment. Two is communication. Sometimes you work with different time zones. If you have to work from the UK with an Australian time zone, how do you make things work? How do you make sure that whatever you do is communicated properly without having to schedule, you know, excessive meetings out of time zone? So these are the things that you have to think about. And three, planning. Planning plays a huge role in remote companies. If you have a good planning for what you need to do, and you have a good platform to follow up on these plannings, it becomes really easy for you to work and trust the people you work with. So at Canonical, we have this sprint where we travel to a country once a year or twice a year, where all the engineers and managers and everyone sit together and look into the roadmap and see where they are. And we also have one that's mid-cycle, usually it's virtual, where we discuss what's going on and track our work that was happening halfway through that 6 months. So having a proper planning and tracking system, I think, is one of the other biggest piece of factor that would make working remotely successful.
Yeah, I think it's a very complicated issue. And as you mentioned at the beginning, that there are many companies who tried that and it didn't work. Actually, they couldn't find this magic formula. It's really hard to almost analyze the source of that, because there's so many variables that can influence the success, even the timing in the market, in the world, in the tech space. Yeah, but every time, especially because Amazon, which is my day job right now, is they are pushing everyone around the world to go back to the office at least 3 days per week, at least. And there's a huge, not a huge, but a noticeable backlash even like that's known in the outside, like in the news articles, that there is a group of employees who are so unhappy with this that just kind of trying to not fight it, but kind of object it at least, or at least try to get more information on the root cause and like the justification. And I don't think they are kind of super happy with that. But I clearly remember that, especially when COVID started, right? When so many companies were forced to rebuild their processes and communication and mechanisms, and even like tracking as well, like as you mentioned, to keep this trust in place during COVID, they had to reinvent this, how they work, right? And arguably, I would say more like a lot of companies could do this and could survive and actually prosper during the work from home days. But now, like, yes, so many companies pushing back. And I see like the pros and cons to both sides. And obviously, as you're saying, it's, I would say there's no kind of right or wrong answer here. Everybody has their own situation and priorities, but it feels like it's kind of impacts, or it will impact, diversity, I would say, an inclusion aspect of a workplace, if you force everyone to go back to the office. Yeah. And especially with not just kind of the disabilities side of the diversity, but also maybe income levels, right? For example, people cannot really, I know lots of people moved out to the country, like further from the big cities, especially in the States, because the price of the real estate is so insane.
Yes.
During the COVID, like as a, almost like a chance to get property, like ownership, right?
Yeah.
And now they have to drop everything and like take their kids back out of school. It's getting complicated. And I empathize with the folks who are really upset about this. For us, it's not as bad because kind of we live pretty close to the office. So it won't be like a big disruption. But frankly, my personal opinion, I would really respect the company's decision to acknowledge and respect personal choice and personal situations.
Right.
So I really admire companies and respect companies who still, regardless of all the benefits and pros and cons and challenges, still allow kind of remote work and more flexibility there. I think it's just more empathetic.
We actually have, I think, 4 or 5 offices around the world. There's one in Austin, one in Boston, one in Taiwan, and one in the UK. And like, you don't have to go to the office if you don't want to. Most people go into the office because they want to socialize with other people. Sometimes we send a message to each other that, hey, I'm going to the office today. Do you want to come by? And that happens maybe like once a month. But I think the biggest factor that plays an important role in remote work is trust. Like as an employee, you should do something to be trusted by, you know, the people you work with in a company. And as a company, you should also trust that the person you hired is actually capable of delivering your work, right? So it's that sense of trust that both party needs to establish in the first place to make this work.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, let's talk now about your job as a hiring manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as far as I remember, you have been a team manager for more than a year now, right?
Not more than a year. I think less than a year, but more than 6 months.
But you have already been interviewing and hiring folks,
yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes, for quite some time.
Awesome. Okay. And probably even like when you were senior, right? Because usually that's a part of the also kind of interview loop. So maybe what I'm curious to hear now is what key takeaways you could share with the UX community, with younger, less experienced designers who are maybe trying to get a job, their first job, second job. What kind of candidates stand out usually? Because at least from my understanding, across the whole tech world, there are more candidates than jobs, sadly.
Yes.
Sadly. And there is a challenge, especially for junior, I guess, less experienced folks, that it's harder to stand out from hundreds of other applicants, right? So maybe you could share some advice and maybe red flags, maybe pro tips on how folks who are applying to jobs can stand out from others and get more attention from the hiring manager and get a job eventually.
Number one is relevance. So by relevance, so let's say Canonical, it's an open source company. If you do something open source, such as contributing to a GitHub project that is open source, whether it's in design or in coding, that definitely would make you stand out because it's relevant to the company. So saying stuff in your resume, for instance, that you work as a bartender at one point in life or, you know, had a part-time job, it will take up some space in your resume, but it doesn't tell us a story of how good you are as a product designer. And it doesn't tell us how relevant your resume is compared to anything that's open source. So relevance is key. Try to find a way to include some of your accomplishments that are relevant to the company that you're applying for, the value of the company that you're applying for, or the job title that you're applying for. If you're applying for a UX role, then whatever project that you work on, whatever competition, make sure that it's relevant to that role, and then you will stand out. Two, I guess, is to do research on the company. Try to do research on what that company values. Sometimes you might have to have multiple versions of your resume because different companies probe for different things. Some companies don't worry too much about degree. Some company worries about degrees. So make sure you include the right information in a way that you can convey that in a resume. Don't make it too long because recruiters don't like it. I guess one of the biggest mistakes, I wouldn't call it mistakes, but one of the things that I see a lot in a resume that a lot of times would make recruiters feel questionable is when you have graphs and charts about your skill set. For instance, you put like Git and then there's like 9 out of 10 scale. If it's a robot that's scanning your resume, these things wouldn't go through. But if it's human who's scanning the resume, sometimes recruiters would be like, so what average or what standard are you comparing this to for someone who has 2 years of experience with a 9 out of 10 in Git? Like, what does that mean? I've known a lot of people who has like 10 years plus experience in Git, and they would still not put themselves at a scale of 9 out of 10. So these are some of the things that can work against you instead of helping. A lot of people also try to contact people in the company asking about, oh, how's my application doing, or follow up on the application. I think a lot of times that usually work against you because most people, they're already filled with work. And if they have to scan, let's say, 2,000 resumes in the pipeline, they're not going to have time to look into one specific resume. So if you want to build connection, try to build connection in different ways. That's not following up on a resume would be my suggestion. Those are some of the things that I can think of on top of my head. Sounds but relevance good. Is key.
Yeah, and I was just going to kind of to touch on that, on the relevance. So one of the, I guess, advice I give to junior folks is really Because like relevance is like it's the other side of the coin of mass application, like applied to every single open job, right? Like kind of almost like generic applications, like trying to get this numbers game up, which I frankly have been advising against, because it's almost like impossible to stand out this way. And when you know exactly which company you're applying to, you did your research, you understand how they think, what's important to them, what they value, it definitely takes a bit more time, so you won't hit the same number of applications total. But it feels to me, and from my experience, that the quality and the outcome, the return on the investment will be higher.
Yeah.
Because as you're saying, like it will help you stand out from everybody else, especially when I remember even like from older jobs when I was involved in the recruiting, reviewing resumes. Definitely, when there was something about from the previous experience, so even education, like what programs they finished, something that more resonated on like the particular, even the market that the company was in, or the type of business they were in, or even like potentially clients they worked with, like when we're talking about agency, it definitely all helps you kind of get like additional point, like to send out. It's almost like the point system that you have there. And I think it's a very, very smart approach to not go the route of mass application to all the open jobs. And I understand that some folks feel desperate, right? And they have like really tough situations when they just kind of maybe don't have time to do that due diligence and invest more time in each application. So I understand that. So it's hard to give one blanket advice, but from the point of view of if you want to stand out from all the other applicants, you should tailor your resume. You should potentially even tailor your portfolio and choose the right projects with the right kind of problems that you worked on and results that would resonate with the hiring manager and other interviewers much more and will give you more chances to get to the next step. I totally agree.
Also choose the right tool to create a resume, because some tools, when you convert it to PDF, the format breaks in the recruitment tool and it's hard to read. So just try to write it and make it simple, not too complicated. And I think that will help whatever automation scans your resume information or you know, those contexts properly. And also it will go through in the right format that wouldn't just reject you. Sometimes you have a lot of quality resume, but the format breaks and we couldn't read it.
Yeah, and I think this is almost like critical for medium to large size companies, because they have more applications per job, and they had to already have been forced to add automated tools for parsing and like all this kind of applicant tracking systems that would parse applications and the resumes. So it's almost like, yeah, they deal with the volume with just overload by adding more tools like this, which work as friction points, because like maybe you have more longer forms to fill out, but also definitely works against creative resumes and all other kind of more less parsable formats that lots of designers want to use to stand out, thinking that they will stand out.
One of the things that Canonical is a little bit different from many companies is we believe that our resume alone is not enough to tell a story about one person. So we have written interviews and you know, essay questions as an additional place to put your information there. And a lot of times candidates would ignore those questionnaires. But I think if you put something in there, it allows us to learn more about you aside from what you put in the resume. So think of it as an opportunity to tell more people about yourself. I would encourage anyone to, if you are ever going to apply for Canonical, I would encourage you to put something in the written interview just to stand out a little bit and tell more about your story.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, especially for companies who want to maybe probe a bit more, a bit deeper on the values or like the parts of the story that almost like works as a, not necessarily, I'm not saying like about the canonical specifically, but like when you add more custom questions to this interview process, to the application process, it almost like the company highlights potentially, and depends on how they phrase the question, highlights their values, right? And they really want to maybe understand how you contribute to the world or any other potential values alignment that they want to achieve. But it also, I think, if you miss this, or if you kind of don't put anything there, I wouldn't be surprised if companies who have this, who invested time to create these custom questions or kind of additional questions to the interview, to the application process, that they may use that as a potential kind of ranking mechanism on which applications to look at first before going to the applications that kind of just bare bones basic information without, because like, and I'm just thinking about like as a hiring manager, I would probably feel that the person is more interested in my particular team, in my particular company, if exactly. they decided to spend like a few more minutes to write that answer, that story, which is important if you want to build, well, I believe, if you want to build a good culture that kind of works for the team. Awesome. Okay, so let me just quickly scan through the questions. I think we went through everything. Okay, yes. Let's wrap up. So last question, if you didn't have to worry about money, what would you do?
Ooh. What would I do? I would still want to become a UXer because it's a job that I really enjoy. It's not, to me, this is not a job. To me, this is like a hobby because I'm learning new things every day. I'm solving people's problems. It's like you're watching a murder mystery movie, and then as the scene takes you through the episode, you sort of get to learn about each character, their motives, and then you finally get to know who the killer is. And that, to me, is UX, to figure out, you know, different aspects of a feature, of a product, of the technology, and then finally figure out how to solve it, finally figure out who's the culprit or come to a conclusion. That is what I really enjoy doing. So maybe it's not a UX job, maybe a detective could be another option for me, but I really like solving puzzles.
Very interesting. Yeah. I actually haven't even considered that this could be an alternative, like passion track, being a detective, like a private detective. This actually would be a very, very interesting story, right? Like going from one world to another and then just completely switching the activity. Interesting. Okay, awesome. If anyone wants to follow up and ask more questions or chat more, is there a way to reach you online?
Oh, definitely. So reach out to me on LinkedIn if you want to talk about stuff. I used to have an ADP list account, but I don't really have time for that anymore because I'm very packed at the moment. But I'm happy to, you know, connect with anyone on LinkedIn, especially if you're in London, if you want to grab coffee or a meal together, happy to get to know you and more about, if you want to learn more about UX or if you want to learn more about London or Berlin or anything at all, more than happy to catch up.
Sweet. And I'll include the link in the notes as usual. Okay, Amy, this was a very delightful and very insightful conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for coming and sharing your lessons learned from your career with the audience. Especially, what was really insightful for me, your observations and takeaways from transitioning to manager, because this is like close and dear to me, like all these thoughts, and very, very, very valuable insights, I think. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kirill. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a fun ride.